You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
For the past 2 weeks, I've been looking at the issue of phosphate from the Western Sahara and the New Zealand companies implicated in the trade, in which Sahrawi people say is an exploitation of their resources by Morocco, who is illegally occupying their land. Firstly, we heard from Tekbir Ahmed Saleh, who is a Sahrawi resistance spokesperson and was born in one of the world's longest-standing refugee camps, formed after Morocco's invasion, and Tekbir's people were forced into the desert.
So we have to fight the double occupation from the south and the north, the neighboring countries. Due to this conflict, hundreds of thousands of refugees, Sahrawis, has to leave the country to Algeria. So people who flee to Algeria, they can't go back to what we call them now, the occupied territory. Basically, the people were divided in half.
We heard of the Sahrawis people's fight for sovereignty over their land and the referendum that was promised in 1991 by the United Nations and agreed to by Morocco. This referendum would allow the people to choose between their independence or to have Morocco's occupation legitimised and continue. We also heard about the obstacles in the way of following through with the 18-year-old promise of a referendum, including the trading of phosphate. Following this, I got in touch with the two New Zealand companies who are the last in the Western world to trade with Morocco. Ravensdown responded with information and a written response, so I am continuing to request an interview with a spokesperson. Balance Agri-Nutrients agreed to an interview, and this is what we heard last week. Science Strategy Advisor Warwick Caddo explained why New Zealand uses so much phosphate, but also why they don't feel it is necessary for them to stop trading with Morocco.
We empathise with what you're saying, but it's outside the mandate of our business to actually have a position on that. That's for governmental entities to deal with, and all we can do is keep them briefed on what we're doing, why we've what our auditing is doing and discovering. So that's about the extent of where we're at.
Both companies state that they are acting legally and that the profits of these exports go into a foundation that benefits the refugees of Western Sahara. I have yet to see direct proof of this, but I am following up. In terms of the legal framework proposed by the UN regarding non-self-governing territories, there are very specific principles for the way in which the political, social and economic aspirations of those territories should be fostered. I wanted to understand the specifics of this framework and the true legal implications of Morocco's occupation of the Western Sahara. The day the interview with Balance Agri-Nutrients was broadcasted, Radio New Zealand had published a statement from a spokesperson for the Polisario Front, Western Sahara's independence movement. Kamal Fadal, who is based in Australia, had stated they were looking into legal action against the companies in New Zealand. So the same day, I reached out to Kamal over Twitter to see if I could speak with him about this, and it turned out he was in New Zealand for the next couple of days. Kamal had actually been part of organising Tekbir's talking tour, and they had taken the rare opportunity of having someone from the Western Sahara visiting New Zealand to meet with government officials and attend conferences. When I contacted Kamal, he was speaking at an event for the New Zealand Institute of International Affairs the following day. I managed to introduce myself at the talk, and he agreed to come into the BFM studios for a discussion. I started by asking what Polisario actually is.
Polisario is a Spanish acronym for, Popular Front for the Liberation of Sahel Hamra and the Rio de Oro, which are the two main areas in Western Sahara. It's a liberation movement recognized by the United Nations as the legitimate representative of the views of the Sahrawi people. It was set up on the 10th of May 1973 to seek independence from Spain. It's the only organization we have in Western Sahara demanding for independence, and it's very popular and people support it.
So, but this is a group that's been going on for a long time, and it started under a Spanish occupation, and now there is a Moroccan occupation. So could you just explain some of the history?
Yeah, we had the unfortunate, situation to be, I think this is a unique situation when a colonial power, instead of doing the right thing, giving the people the right to self-determination and also doing a smooth decolonization process, they didn't do that. They instead made an agreement with two neighboring countries, that is Spain, which was the colonial power, Morocco and Mauritania, on the 14th of November 1975, in order to divide the territory between them, and Spain maintains economic interests in the territory. So we had to face a new colonialism from two neighboring countries, and a new occupation, a new invasion, which we suffered from. bombardment, armies moving in, people fleeing the territory, thousands of refugees. And since then, you know, 44 years later, the situation remains the same. Oppression, occupation, denial of basic rights, hundreds of people still in political prisoners in detention, and Morocco, you know, benefits from the resources of the territory.
I want to just make this really clear. So in 1975, and I'm going to quote from your submission to actually our parliament, right? In 1975, the International Court of Justice concluded there was no tie of territorial sovereignty between the territory of Western Sahara and the Kingdom of Morocco. So essentially, there's no such legal tie that might jeopardize the General Assembly's resolution 1514XV. So there's two things there, right? Yeah. Actually... Nobody recognizes Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara, and that is a fact.
Yes. Well, what I mean, the Moroccan claimed to the UN and that Western Sahara was historically part of Morocco. And they sought an opinion, a legal opinion, from the International Court of Justice, whether Western Sahara belonged to Mauritania or Morocco, or it was, whether it was terra nullius, belonging to no one. And if not, did Morocco have any legal ties over the territory? And the court was very clear in its conclusion. No, Western Sahara was not terra nullius. It had a people who were organized in a system by themselves. And also, you know, a council of 40, we call it, tribal leadership. And they did not have any legal ties of such a nature that might deny the right to self-determination. Neither Morocco nor Mauritania. The United Nations is mandated to organize a referendum or to seek the opinion of the people they want to be in the future after colonialism, after the Spanish withdrawal. And also, at the moment, no country in the world recognizes Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara. On the other hand, you will find about over 80 countries worldwide recognize the Sahrawi Republic, which we declared, and we are a member of the African Union. So we have more recognition than Morocco. And Morocco has nothing, none.
Yet they continue this occupation and they publicly display an uncontested occupation of the region. So how exactly is that sovereignty, and I put that in quotes, being reinforced? What does this occupation look like?
Well, like all occupations historically, when you occupy a land, people are oppressed, treated like second citizens in their country. Morocco's aim mainly was in those years, in the beginning, is to divert attention from problems inside Morocco itself, because the king at that time just faced a number of coup attempts against him. So he wanted to send the army away from Morocco, divert attention, have a nationalistic call, an issue. And, you know, the Sahrawis are facing terrible conditions. As I mentioned, disappearances, you know, people were kidnapped, thousands of them. Even if they just suspected that they had some links with Polisario or a family member was a member of the Polisario, they would be, you know, taken and detained and killed. Poverty, marginalization, oppression, basic denial of basic rights, of assembly, of protest. If you wave the flag of the Western Sahara in any street in occupied Western Sahara now, you will be detained, tortured. Independent observers, media, parliamentarians are not allowed to come. Yesterday, two Danish activists were thrown out of Western Sahara because they just had on their phone or pictures of the Sahrawi refugee camps. It's a horrible, terrible situation.
And there's a wall, right? A physical wall that separates the people from their land.
Yeah, Morocco built this horrendous construction. They call it the berm. We call it the wall of shame. 2,700 kilometers long, 3 to 4 meters high, with barbed wire, with 140,000 soldiers behind it, very well equipped, trenches, rocks, radars, dogs, and 7 to 10 million landmines in order to protect the useful areas of Western Sahara, the mines, for example, the phosphate mines, and to deny, you know, connection between the people. So it separates the liberated areas, which we control, and the occupied areas. But it has, you know, most of the useful parts of Western Sahara are behind it, occupied by Morocco. So, and this is not going to be, you know, a problem now, but for the future, to clear those landmines will be an uphill task. And it continues to affect civilians, animals, and it was also a great environmental damage to our land because they cut all the trees, they poisoned all the wells because so the nomads don't get close to the water sources near the wall. And it kills all the animals because of landmines.
There's refugee camps, but there are also Sahrawi's people within the occupied area and settlers also in the occupied area. So what does that look like?
Mm. We have, when Morocco invaded, thousands of Sahrawis had to flee the invasion and seek refuge first in Western Sahara, but they were bombarded with cluster bombs and napalms. And they moved to safe areas in along the border with Algeria, which offered a part of its territory for these refugees. So they are not bombarded by Morocco. And they set up refugee camps there. 173,000 people in these refugee camps now, completely dependent on humanitarian assistance and in a very harsh environment, an area which no one lived in before, complete desert. 50 degrees Celsius during the summer, freezing at night, no trees, you know, scarce water, and very little food. You know, Secretary General of the United Nations report, which came out just a few days ago, describes the alarming situation and the terrible situation the refugees face because of the lack of food and medicine and basic, you know, needs. This is the situation in the refugee camps. On the other hand, were people who could not flee the Moroccan invasion remained in the occupied areas. So it was a horrible situation because separation of families. Kids probably managed to flee and the parents left behind, or someone was visiting or family and, you know, they left in a, they had a car and left and they, you know, the rest of the family remained in the occupied areas. People could not see each other for decades and didn't know what was happening to the other person. And that situation also remains now. Although in the 90s, the United Nations organized something called confidence-building measures for people to visit each other for 5 days after separation of decades. But Morocco stopped this, so it's not happening anymore. So occupied areas face a lot of problems because of Morocco's occupation and oppression, and the refugees face also problems because of exile and harsh conditions and the separation and war.
Let's just touch on the referendum, right? So so there was the occupation and the invasion and then a ceasefire in 1991. This is what I understand. And my understanding too is that actually the Sahrawi's people were winning before 1991 because obviously they knew the land. Yeah. That was their land. Here in New Zealand, the indigenous people were called tangata whenua, which literally means people of the land. Mm-hmm. And the Moroccans didn't really know the land, and so they weren't doing so well. They weren't very successful in this. So you spoke about the king actually accepting the ceasefire and accepting the referendum, but this might have actually been more of a pragmatic move.
Mm.
So can you explain what the referendum is and why it's not occurred yet?
We were a small people and not very well armed when in 1975 we didn't have anyone helping us, but we had, you know, some very important things. One is the conviction of the just cause, and also the love of our land and the knowledge of our land and the determination to fight for our rights and our homeland. So we mobilized, and historically the Sahrawis also are good fighters. So we managed in a couple of years to make Mauritania, which took half of our land, agree to a peace plan and a peace deal, and also withdraw from the part it withdrew and sign a peace treaty with the Polisario and the Sahrawi Republic and recognize the Sahrawi Republic. We continued with our struggle against Morocco, which had a huge army, well-equipped, well-financed, by some Gulf states and also with the support of some Western countries, giving them intelligence and training and supplying them with arms. And we had, not many people, but amazingly, very successful in the war, liberating a large area of our territory, reaching to the southern Morocco cities in South Morocco, and causing substantial damages to the Moroccan army and imprisoning, taking prisoners, thousands of Moroccan soldiers, and making the war very expensive for Morocco, costing them a lot of money to maintain the war, spending maybe around at least $2 million a day during the war. That caused a lot of issues in Morocco, problems, because Morocco is not a very rich country. And also the king and the regime realized that this cannot be sustained. They have to find a way out of it. At that time, the United Nations and the African Union were proposing a peace deal based on a ceasefire. They call it the settlement plan. And also with the view to organize a referendum at the end for the Sahrawi people to exercise their rights to self-determination. And the king took that opportunity, but with no intention to go ahead. We didn't know that at the time. It was just a way to have the ceasefire and to maintain the occupation, continue the exploitation of resources, and hope that the Sahrawis will feel tired or, wither away. And that's why we have, no referendum until now. Morocco just blocks it, disrupts it, does not cooperate with the United Nations, does not implement what it signed on to, and the UN has been weak and not putting pressure on Morocco to abide by the settlement plan.
What can the UN do to actually hold Morocco to account for not abiding, basically?
Well, they can issue a strong resolution in the Security Council demanding Morocco to respect the settlement plan and cooperate with the United Nations and implement the referendum. If Morocco does not abide by that, but I would be surprised because Morocco is not a strong country to face the United Nations Security Council and the international community, they will immediately do that. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that we have a France which has the veto power in the Security Council and will not allow such a resolution to happen. I mean, the United Nations, most of the Security Council wanted to see human rights monitoring included in the mandate of MINURSO, the United Nations Mission in Western Sahara, which does not have that mandate now. It's an exception to the rule because all other UN peacekeeping missions have that mandate. The mission in Western Sahara does not. And there has been calls for it to have the mandate to monitor and report on human rights. And France blocked that. So you can imagine that they will not allow a strongly worded resolution to be adopted in the Security Council. Mm.
This ceasefire and the resolution for a referendum, which would allow for the Western Sahara people to vote on their own independence and allow for that possibility, that was in 1991. So now we're in 2019. What is it that actually is stopping Morocco from moving out of this region?
I said, I mentioned the weakness of the United Nations and the fact that the Sahrawis have been really nice, doing the right thing, not doing any untoward actions like trying to, do terrorist acts or draw attention to their cause. So we tend to be ignored because of that, because we're playing by the rules of the United Nations and the international community and international law. So our issue is always looked at as not, important issue, and the international community attention is diverted by bigger issues like what's happening in Syria at the moment, or before what was happening in Iraq or Afghanistan or other areas. So unfortunately, until there is another war in West Sahara or some big things happening there, the international community will not pay attention. So Morocco is comfortable now, is enjoying the fact that no one is putting pressure on it internationally, and there is no war. I mean, we have an uprising, but people protest in Western Sahara, in the occupied areas, but they are outnumbered by the settlers, they are outnumbered by the Moroccan army, which is really well armed and well equipped. And the moment Sahrawis go to the street, they are detained, tortured, put in prison, and they have no other ability to continue to do that. So
there is also a monetary interest, right, in Morocco remaining in this
of
region.
Of course.
So this is what I mostly want to talk about, yeah. Phosphate. And phosphate is also related to food security, but it's also a finite resource. Everyone wants to keep hold of their stock and mine someone else's, right, because it is limited. And I wanted to get you to discuss this sort of, because you were clear that this is absolutely related to Morocco's interest in maintaining their occupation of the region, because they actually have a monopoly over this resource.
Yep.
And it's a multi-billion dollar trade, yes?
Yes.
So can we just talk about this phosphate in the region?
Yeah, I mean, if we look at the beginning, the reason for Morocco to move in the territory is because it's a large territory. It's the size of Great Britain, Western Sahara. It has a lot of resources, very rich in mineral resources, phosphates, iron ore, gold, uranium, and also fisheries. And it has a great potential for oil and gas. So the reason is because Morocco is benefiting from it. And that's why they keep a grip on it, despite all our pressure by the war and by diplomacy and everything. They don't want to move out because they're benefiting in a great deal from this territory, millions of dollars from exploiting resources. Not only, you know, the phosphates, the fisheries, but agriculture, sand, now renewable energy, salt, you name it. Whatever they could do, they exploit and sell. Even sand to the beaches in Spain. Until they feel that the benefit is not there, they will continue doing that. As you said, you know, the phosphate is an important commodity and it puts Morocco in a very strong position to, you know, influence the price of phosphate and the supply of phosphate. And they use it also as a political tool to influence other countries in their position on Western Sahara. So it's not only an economic tool, but also a political one.
So on the extraction of resources, before we sort of continue on phosphate, can you just tell me what it means to be a non-self-governing territory? So so what rights are promised to a region that is a non-self-governing territory?
Non-self-governing territories usually have an administering power, which can have a right to exploit resources to a certain limit, just for the benefit of the population and with their consent. In our case...
And those are two very key points.
Yes, yes. Those are preconditions, non-qua conditions, which means they have to implement them. And Morocco, in this case, is not even considered as the administering power. It's legally, Spain is still the de jure administering power of Western Sahara. Because what happened in 1975, in the eyes of the United Nations, does not satisfy a decolonization process. And historically, Morocco was not the colonial power in Western Sahara. It's an illegal occupation. And the exploitation of resources is like theft. It's like if you are dealing with those goods, they are like stolen goods. Morocco has no right to sell those. It's like if someone, you know, breaks into a house or in a car and takes some goods out of it and sell them on the street. And if you buy them and the police catch you, you will be dealing with stolen goods. That's what Ravensdown and Balance are doing now. They're dealing with stolen goods. So in that sense, Morocco is not the administering power, but also even if it is considered as the administering power, we have never been consulted about our resources. We don't benefit at all from those resources. So those conditions are not met in Western Sahara.
Because first and foremost, it is an illegal occupation.
Yeah.
And then secondly, and I quote, right, so the principle of permanent sovereignty over natural resources means that the occupying or administering power, which in this case it is an illegal one, may not subordinate the rights and interests of those peoples to foreign economic and financial interests, right? When this is
absolutely,
this is what is currently happening.
Yeah.
We'll come back to the stolen goods. Let's talk about phosphate and the money that comes from it. So 2,100 people are being employed in this mine, and you say the Sahrawi's people are not benefiting at all, right? So not many jobs are going to them. And anyone who protests that is targeted by Moroccan police and security forces. This is all occurring, right? The entire corporate interest is now held by OCP. Can you explain what OCP is? And I suppose, yeah, where's this money going?
Yes. OCP is a Moroccan company. It's a holding which is mainly owned by the royal family. It has a subsidiary called Fosbokra, which is managing the mines in West Sahara. And it's controlled by OCP, of course. So any money received goes into the coffers of the Moroccan regime and mainly to the king, the royal family.
This is the king that was called the King of Rock,
yes,
by the Forbes,
yes,
Forbes list.
That's right. And when Spain left, there were a number of Sahrawis working in the mines, mainly Sahrawis. Morocco comes in, dismisses all of them, most of them, not all of them, few left, in, and then brings in the settlers and the Moroccans to manage these the mines and work in them and have the important positions. I think out of those 2,200 employees, maybe 300, maximum 500 Sahrawis who are given very ordinary jobs and they're not paid very well. And those who were dismissed are not receiving their pensions. So if you look at the investment or benefit to the Sahrawi people, the situation is that most Sahrawis are poor, unemployed in Western Sahara, and outnumbered by settlers, Moroccan settlers who moved from the north, who got the good jobs. There is, for example, no university in Western Sahara after 44 years of occupation by Morocco. There are no good hospitals, no good schools, no good roads, no infrastructure.
There's no money going into building that infrastructure for those people.
Yes. And if Sahrawis want to study or have really good medical attention, they have either to go to Morocco or to the Canary Islands or to Spain. And the situation is not good. It's not as, you know, for example, described by the companies who say that, you know, everything is good, is happening and investment is going in. It's all lies and rubbish because that's what they are told by the Moroccans. I mean, if Mark Wayne from Balance goes to Al Ayun, he's not going to go and visit a Sahrawi family or, you know, look into the, you know, neighborhoods where Sahrawis live. He's going to be taken on a tour, maybe put in a 5-star hotel, driven around in a Mercedes or BMW and given, a presentation, PowerPoint presentation, you know, with all these figures and all this information, which does not reflect the reality, at least for the Sahrawis. I'm not sure about the settlers, Moroccan settlers. So it's all fiction when you say that Sahrawis are benefiting and enjoying Moroccan occupation.
And there's actually, I mean, because the other point is consent, right? So the idea that there is Sahrawi's representatives who have given consent for this exploitation of resource to occur. But actually in 2016, the CJEU found no evidence of that consent. So it is fiction.
Absolutely. Morocco has no right to be in Western Sahara or be exploiting those resources. No one has given it that right. Neither the international law nor the Sahrawis. So we don't consent and we don't benefit. And there has been never a referendum to find out what the Sahrawis want with their resources and with their also right to self-determination. And who are these representatives that Morocco claims or the companies claim have given consent? There has been no, you know, a poll of Sahrawis. And if we look at this 173,000 Sahrawis living in the camps, Morocco has never talked to them, and they can't. And also, the companies have never been there. We have invited, you know, these companies to visit Sahrawis in the refugee camps, and they declined to come and see for themselves the situation and ask the Sahrawis what they want. So we have, there is no evidence of all these claims. Also, the companies mentioned that they have legal opinion giving them the right to be there and to do whatever they're doing. Will they share that legal opinion? Will they publish it? I don't think so. It could be an in-house legal opinion from a solicitor, you know, there, or it could be something which does not have, you know, strong evidence or not based on really facts and just a claim.
So back to the stolen goods, I just want to point out what happened in May 2017, where a shipment of phosphate was detained in South Africa, and it was actually found by the South Africa High Court that Morocco had no right to sell this. Essentially, it was owned by Western Sahara. So that's a really, really positive precedent in your favour in mm-hmm. that sense to have found that. So essentially, yes, we're dealing with stolen goods, and I guess I want to come specifically to the New Zealand companies that we have mentioned, but we haven't sort of really talked about. And New Zealand is the last Western country to still trade with Morocco. And you mentioned, obviously, there is an Indian company, but it's part owned by Morocco. Mm. So it sort of, in a way, doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
New Zealand has two companies, and so therefore they are the last ones external to Morocco who are still trading with stolen goods, as you've said. So again, it's shocking to me that this is occurring, and that there has been, I think, 20 years of communication with these companies.
Yeah.
So they are well aware of what is actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
You say that this exploitation of resources and the importing by New Zealand companies is presenting an obstacle to the resolution, right? So this is a direct obstacle to achieving the referendum. Can you explain that?
As we mentioned earlier, the reason for Morocco to be in Western Sahara is in order to have, you know, to benefit from the resources. As long as Morocco is benefiting, it's going to be not cooperating with the United Nations and not abiding by international law and not allowing the referendum to take place. So the companies now are encouraging Morocco to be there, and they're not facilitating the resolution. They are impeding it, complicating it, and not being part of the solution, but part of the problem. So giving Morocco resources, giving them, you know, encouragement, moral support, and kind of recognizing that Morocco has a right to be in West Sahara, which does not have. So if you deal with Morocco, you're giving them recognition. So I think the companies, if they stopped, they will help. They will be first doing the right thing, the moral, the ethical, the legal thing. And also they will be assisting in ending this conflict and having a resolution, which is beneficial for these companies. Because if the issue is resolved, they will have no problem in you know, dealing with Western Sahara phosphates. And they have been told by the New Zealand Ministry of Foreign Affairs to do that, to find an alternative. So they say, our government has not said anything. The government has met on many occasions through ministers of trade and agriculture and told the companies to seek actively an alternative, because this issue is damaging the reputation of New Zealand now, being the only remaining country in Western Sahara, you know, through these companies, is causing you know, a problem for the standing, the reputation of New Zealand as a country. So this is affecting the whole country, the whole people, the image of the country, and it's causing a huge damage. So the companies should listen to, you know, United Nations, should listen to MIFAT, and should abide by international law. They say that we don't have another alternative. They do. Phosphate is available in many other countries. And if they invested a little bit in what is called regenerative thermal oxidizer, they could find an alternative, like what CSPP in Australia did. It was doing the same thing that the New Zealand companies are doing now. But they had the will to find an alternative, and they invested little money to change their equipments to deal with phosphate from other parts of the world, which is available. So there is no excuse not to do that. And it could be done easily. It could be done, you know, in the next few months.
And that's because so there are sort of three main reasons, right, that the New Zealand companies in particular argue that they don't need to, or they shouldn't, or they can't, you know, their hands are tied, that sort of thing. So they often talk about that phosphate is of high quality in Western Sahara, and obviously New Zealand uses a lot of phosphate. So countries that have pulled out, like Canada, Australia, America, they don't trade with Morocco anymore in regards to this issue. New Zealand claims that obviously they need a lot more, and therefore it's necessary to get it from the kind of highest source. I suppose this is the largest source. They also say it's a complex issue that they don't want to get involved because they can't. It's outside of their mandate to deal with the UN and governments and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you've also pointed out, I suppose, that you just want them to not be part of the problem, right? It's that idea of their business mandate is the business, in the sense that you are still providing business, and therefore that is still going ahead. And then you've also already debunked this myth, I suppose, that the trade is beneficial for the population of Western Sahara.
Yeah.
Now, I guess the three, if we're talking sort of just black and white, the three reasons, two, you've mentioned two, that the reputation of New Zealand and our values, we like to think that we are
a good country
and that we fight for Indigenous rights, you know, that we're proud of these things.
Yeah.
But this is actually a stain on that reputation.
Yes.
There's also, I mean, just commercially, there is a risk here for a company, right? If you are a company as a business, you can see sort of an unstable investment, right? This is probably considered, it's not really guaranteed in the future. One, as a particular place of a resource, but two, the resource itself is finite, right? Yeah. And so there is, of course, issues that need to be dealt with there in finding alternatives. Mm. And as you've just mentioned, there are already alternatives.
Mm.
So it's almost that the companies are just choosing not to engage with this, or?
Yes, I think the problem here is that the farmers, they don't have the right information. And we have some really, unfortunately, very arrogant CEO men who are very comfortable in their position. They get very well paid. They are becoming really lazy to do some more work to find alternatives. And they're intransigent, strong-headed, and they think they can just fight this. But they're wrong, because legally wrong, morally wrong, ethically wrong, and it's not a good business also move. Because as you said, they should be really concerned that this could stop tomorrow and they need to find an alternative. But with regard, let me go back to this issue of, this is a complex issue, we don't want to be involved, it's not our job. We have never said that either Ravensdown or Balance should come and resolve the political issues. They're not the United Nations, and that's not their job, of course, or task. But they like it or not, they are involved. They are, on one side, supplying millions of dollars to an occupier, which uses that money to oppress a people and occupy a land. And it's a lot of money. It's been going on also for 30 years. So they are involved. And until they stop, they continue to be involved. And they're complicating the issue. They're encouraging Morocco to continue to defy international law and abuse human rights and oppress the people. So they need to realize that and accept it. Second, with regard to phosphate from somewhere else, as I mentioned, they could easily change their equipment and bring phosphate from other sources, like they do now bring 30% from other sources to New Zealand. Or also maybe think in the long term that phosphate is not the right thing for New Zealand environment, and find also other ways to not to have this addiction to phosphate and dependence on phosphate, particularly when this is, you know, now called blood phosphate from Western Sahara, like blood diamonds. And it's really not something which I think a lot of people in New Zealand agree with, that these companies should continue to deal with this issue and cause a lot of suffering to another people, another territory, deny us of our income for the future. We have suffered for decades because of the occupation, because of exile, because of oppression. And when we have our independence, we don't want to find ourselves in the same situation as Nauru, for example, with no resource to rebuild our country and to have a dignified life for our people who have suffered a lot. 173,000 of them live in terrible conditions with 50% anemia. Malnutrition is huge in the refugee camps. So it's, I think, time for them to realize that enough is enough.
And can I confirm that you are considering legal action?
Yes, we are, looking very seriously at legal action, and we have been, preparing for it, and it is going to happen soon. We have a plan, we have lawyers, and we are ready for it.
What is it that you would say, because I'm quite interested in, I feel like if you're, the conditions in Western Sahara, the conditions there are incredibly dangerous for people that are speaking out, right, or that are protesting. So when you are going about your work, I suppose, do you ever feel that similar risk? Or, how do you feel when you come into New Zealand, this country that is involved in essentially the occupation of your country?
I feel good because I meet a lot of people who didn't know about this issue and who, when they hear about it, they really sympathize and want to do something about it. I'm sure there are some people who don't care, and some, people like CEOs of Palace and Ravensdown who don't agree with me and they don't like me much. But I'm not seeking to really make them happy in that way. We are just asking for our basic rights, We're not asking for anything else. No favors or anything. And we just, want to help our people and, achieve our rights and our independence and to preserve our resources, which have been plundered and stolen from us by Morocco. And now they are coming into New Zealand. But I have never felt, that I'm at risk or anything, because this is a democratic country. I would not be visiting Morocco. And it's a country which, as we have always liked and loved New Zealand because of its good image, which we have known for many years, and position on issues like East Timor and South Africa. And also in Western Sahara, it's the position has been, at the level of the United Nations, positive. But this issue now is damaging that reputation, and it's causing a lot of problem for the image of New Zealand and its standing, and how the Sahrawi people, when I go to the camps, the refugee camps, the people can't understand why New Zealand wouldn't stop, and what's going on. This is not something they expect to happen. But I give them assurances that there are a lot of good New Zealanders, who don't agree with Ravensdown and Balance.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.